For antiwar.com and Chaos Radio 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas, I'm Scott Horton, and this is Anti-War Radio. $3 trillion budget. New national intelligence estimate telling us that the case in Iraq is basically hopeless. And just last night, the war party successfully thwarted an attempt by some in the Imperial Senate to pass a non-binding resolution disapproving of Bush's escalation of troops. The war in Iraq, roundly agreed by everyone outside of the vice president's office, as a total disaster at this point. And to help us understand the situation in Iraq and perhaps spreading into Iran is history professor Juan Cole from the University of Michigan. His indispensable blog, Informed Comment, is available at juancole.com. And I'm here to tell you this guy blogs more by 6 a.m. than most people blog all day. Welcome to the show, Juan.
Thank you.
It's good to talk with you again. Now, you are a fluent Arabic speaker and a Middle East expert, right?
Right.
Everyone, Juan is the author of at least half a dozen books or more, but three of them are Colonialism and Revolution in the Middle East, Modernity and the Millennium, and Sacred Space and Holy War, the Politics, Culture, and History of Shiite Islam. And when I say his blog informed comment is indispensable, believe me, I mean it. So the subject today, obviously, Iraq and Iran, but let's start with Iraq. 1,000 Iraqis were estimated killed just in the last week. Helicopters are being shot down, and threats are flying from the administration that it's all Iran's fault. So I'm glad I have you here, Professor Cole, to help flesh out some of these details. If it's all right with you, I guess I'd like to make gross oversimplifications of the situation to the best of my understanding, and then hopefully you can help flesh out some of the details and help get us to the real point.
All right.
So I guess just Iraq 101 here. Saddam Hussein and his Baathists were primarily secular Sunni Baathists, which was basically the fascist party in Iraq. And when the U.S. invaded, toppled the leadership, and fired all the government employees, they basically empowered the Shiite majority that had been suppressed all along under Saddam Hussein. Good so far?
Yep.
Okay, now, the Shiites who hold positions of power under the American occupation are people from three main groups: the Mahdi Army of Muqtada al-Sadr, the Dawah Party, and the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq. And right now, America backs the Shiites, and more specifically, the Dawah Party and the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution, the parties backed by Iran, against the primarily Sunni insurgency and against Muqtada al-Sadr and his Mahdi Army, right?
That is correct.
Okay, so in terms of different goals for the future of how Iraq ought to be run, my understanding is that Sadr is a nationalist, whereas the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution and the Dawah Party, the two that are primarily backed by Iran, could really give or take a central state. They want Baghdad, but other than that, they basically want autonomy for the South and an alliance with Iran. Is that right?
Well, the Supreme Council wants that. The Dawah Party is split. Traditionally, they were also in favor of a strong central government, but some of their members have hived off and adopted the decentralized position of the Supreme Council.
Mm-hmm. But now when the Bush regime talks about Maliki's time may be running out and they're getting sick and tired of him, he's from the Dawah Party, what they're doing is they're leaning even more toward the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution. Isn't that right?
That's probably the case. The chief competitor to al-Maliki as possible prime minister would be a man from the Supreme Council.
Al-Mahdi, right?
Iraq. Yes, Adel Abdel Mahdi is his name.
Mm-hmm. So here we are. The United States basically is backing the same parties that Iran is backing in Iraq at the same time that our government is accusing Iran of... I guess the accusations are always very vague, but they seem to be implying that Iran is backing the Sunni insurgency that's fighting the American soldiers. Is that right?
Well, they're vague, so we don't know who they think they're backing, but they're accusing them of mischief-making and bringing in weapons and so forth. The Iranians are not helping the Sunni guerrilla movement, what the U.S. calls the insurgency. And that is responsible for almost all of the attacks on U.S. troops and a very large proportion of the attacks on everybody else. So Iran is not the problem in Iraq on the whole. And the National Intelligence Estimate that just came out last week concludes that this is internally driven and that the neighbors just are not that big a part of it.
Right. And now the accusation is that the apparently increasingly deadly improvised explosive devices that are being set off on the roads, that those are coming from Iran. But again, that's the Sunni insurgency that's fighting with those weapons. America's not at war against the Shiites, the Iran-backed parties.
Well, what the specifics of what's being alleged in that regard is that there is a special kind of IED or a roadside bomb, an explosively shaped projectile, which is very sophisticated and can penetrate the armor of an Abrams tank, that a few of those have shown up in southern Iraq among Shiite militias that have attacked coalition troops, mainly, as far as I can tell, the British. And that there are deep, dark suspicions that some of the components in those specialized bombs have been milled in Iran. That in and of itself, of course, wouldn't prove that the Iranian government gave these things to these militias, and most of the militias in the south that are attacking coalition troops, which does happen, especially the British have lost now 100 men and women, most of those southern Shiite militias, as you say, are actually anti-Iranian. And so it's a little unlikely that the Iranian government is handing over to them high-powered war material.
Yeah, and again, the accusations are so vague that it's the kind of thing that you and I can't even necessarily really nail down their point in order to contradict it, because they won't come right out and say, well, Iran is backing the Sunni insurgency and giving them roadside bombs, because we just laugh them out, you know, right off of TV, if they try to put it that way.
They actually did try to put it that way about a year and a half ago, and nobody took them seriously. So over time, this sort of propaganda against Iran, which, to be fair, you know, for all we know, it could have a kernel of truth, but the problem is it's disproportionate. This propaganda against Iran has evolved over time. Whatever is being alleged, you know, whatever is coming from Iran is a tiny proportion of the problem. The Iranians have every interest in seeing a stable, a unified Iraq. They're pleased as punch with the rise to dominance of the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution Iraq, which is their guys. That party was formed in Tehran in 1982 at the suggestion of Ayatollah Khomeini. So why in the world would they be sending in weapons to anybody who wanted to destabilize that government? They're not. If anything, they might be giving behind the scenes some weapons to the same people that the United States is giving weapons to, and it is not impossible that some of those are being sold off or smuggled.
And wasn't there even a communication that was intercepted or something somewhere where Iran was basically instructing the Supreme Council, hey, play it cool. Don't do anything disruptive. Have patience. The Americans are turning the whole country over to us. Don't do anything stupid.
Yeah, that sentiment has been said publicly. I mean, it's not just a matter of capturing documents.
Mm-hmm. And now, if I remember correctly, Professor Cole, the first time that you and I spoke almost 2 years ago, we discussed the fact that the Americans are now in the position, and I guess have been in the position, of protecting the Sunni minority that they're fighting from the majority that they've empowered. And this would seem to be reaffirmed by Dick Cheney's trip to Saudi Arabia, where he promised the Saudis that we will not pull out and leave them to defend the Sunni Arabs in Iraq from the majority that we've empowered. So is it right to say that 3,000 Americans have died fighting a Sunni insurgency that they're there to protect from the majority that we've put in power there?
Well, the dynamics of this are awfully complicated, but I wouldn't put it exactly that way. So far, the United States continues to mainly fight the Sunnis. surge that's being talked about, 4,000 of those men are going to be put in Al Anbar province, which is almost entirely Sunni, and a large number of the 17,500 that are going to Baghdad will be mainly concerned with Sunni Arab districts in the west of the city. So the U.S. has all along been in Iraq to overthrow the Sunni Arab minority of 20%, to destroy the Ba'ath Party, which was their main vehicle of power, and then to repress that community and crush it in favor of the Shiites and the Kurds. And, of course, this project is extremely distasteful to all the Sunni Arab neighbors of Iraq, and Cheney is constrained to try to tell them that, well, we won't completely crush the Sunni Arabs and we won't allow the Shiites to commit genocide against them. But those are that's pretty weak tea.
Yeah. 2 years ago when we first talked, it was, I believe, Barzani and some representatives from Skiri had come forward and said, look, just send the Peshmergas and the Badr Brigades. We'll clean up this Sunni insurgency. And the Americans' response was, thanks, but no thanks. Oh, no, what a rock and a hard place.
Well, in actual fact, the U.S. Did forestall the participation of the Badr Corps, the paramilitary or militia of the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution Iraq, from participating in the overthrow of Saddam Hussein, and threatened to arrest them if they found them on the battlefield and kill them and so forth. But after the fall of Saddam, some 15,000 of these fighters came back from Iran, where they had been based, and established themselves and grew. They recruited Iraqis on the ground. They had freedom to now organize. And they even turned themselves into a political party, which has seats not only in parliament but on provincial councils. And so they've become a power to reckon with, whether the United States liked it or not.
Yeah, and now, if we go back to the beginning of the war, you talked about how America has basically been fighting all along to install the Shia in power, but at the beginning, I remember, I guess they believed Chalabi's lies that they were going to get a Hashemite kingdom like in Jordan, and then I remember also that there was some media that Tony Blair had tried to convince Bush that, well, what we need to do is try to, you know, if not reinstall the Ba'ath Party particularly, we need to at least keep the Sunni minority in power, and that it really wasn't until the Ayatollah Sistani came out and said, we demand direct elections, that basically they were forced to turn the country over to the Shiite majority in the South. Is that close?
Well, that's certainly the intervention of Grand Ayatollah Sistani was crucial, because he demanded one person, one vote, and since the Shiites are the majority, that ensured that they would come to power in the polls. What the Bush administration didn't reckon with was that the Shiites of Iraq had gone fundamentalist in the course of the 1990s. They didn't know that, and when they initially overthrew Saddam, as you say, Bush expected to be able to install Ahmad Chalabi in power in Iraq as a kind of Karzai figure, as a kind of soft dictator almost for the Americans. And Chalabi is a relatively secular man who had assured the Bush administration that he could rule Iraq and he had all kinds of allies, and that the Shia of Iraq were secular in mindset. And none of that was true, and Chalabi, in the end, couldn't even win a seat to parliament in open elections.
Right, and it turned out, of course, that he was an Iranian spy, right?
Well, Chalabi, like many of the Iraqi Shiites, has strong relations with Tehran, and at some point, somebody told Chalabi, and it may well have been one of the neoconservatives in his circle, that the U.S. had broken Iranian encryption, that we were reading all of their internal memos because we had broken their code. And, of course, they immediately changed their encryption and made Iran opaque to the United States, which was a very inconvenient development given that we were trying to watch them for their weapons programs and so forth. So Chalabi, deeply and profoundly damaged, if this allegation is true, the security of the United States. And since one of the ways that war with Iran could have been avoided was that precisely that the U.S. knew exactly what the internal workings of the regime were, by making it opaque, it made it more likely that the U.S. would grow suspicious and seek war. So I'm, even in my dark moments, suspicious of why somebody told Chalabi this, and did they know he'd take it straight to the Iranians?
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was going to say, there's two points there. One, there were media reports, I don't know how accurate they were, that at least some people in the Defense Intelligence Agency were concerned that Chalabi had not just warned the Iranians that their codes had been broken, but in fact that his job as a spy was to lure America into overthrowing Saddam Hussein for Iran. And then the second thing I was going to say was, it reminds me of Valerie Plame when you talk about cutting off America's access to information about what's really going on to Iran. Wasn't Plame working on Iran's black market nuclear program stuff?
Plame was working on the Iranian proliferation, and however, I don't think that these things are connected in that way.
It just seems that the less information you have, the easier it is to lie.
Yeah, the Chalabi and his circle in London, of these Iraqi expatriates, Kurds, Shiites, some Sunnis, ex-Baathists, they had been organizing for over a decade to try to overthrow Saddam, and had gotten support from various branches of the U.S. military and intelligence establishment. So it is obviously the case that Iran didn't mind that at all, and may even have urged it on, but it wasn't that Chalabi suckered the U.S. into doing something solely because Iran wanted it done. With regard to Plame, I think it was irrelevant to Cheney and Bush whether Plame was working on Iran or what she was working on. They wanted to destroy the Wilson family for having dared stand up to them. They're extremely vindictive people.
So you think the fact that they shut down the Brewster Jennings and Associates CIA front company investigation into Iran's attempts to purchase material from the black market just happened to be a lucky coincidence for Cheney then?
Well, I think I think Cheney probably did not know the full extent of Plame's undercover status, and that this would have these dire consequences for the entire anti-proliferation covert operation. If he did know that, and he did it anyway, then the act was truly criminal.
Okay, now, let me see if I can get you to help me understand a little bit more about Muqtada al-Sadr and his Mahdi army. The death squads that they talk about, the Shiite death squads that go around murdering Sunnis, are those primarily the Badr Brigades or the Mahdi army, or entirely different groups that I don't know of?
Well, the Badr Brigade is more disciplined and more of a cadre kind of organization than the Mahdi army, but it has been accused of running death squads as well. But the main source of ethnic cleansing, ethnic reprisals, sectarian reprisals, these strikes in the night on Sunni neighborhoods and so forth, appears to be the Mahdi army.
Mm-hmm. And now, to what degree are the Mahdi army and the Badr Brigades fighting each other?
They have fought one another. They are locked in a political battle for control of the Shiite South. They are not actively fighting one another at the moment. There have been skirmishes from time to time. There was one in fall of 2005 in Karbala, but there seems to be a lot of militia turf wars of that sort in Basra, in the southern port city. There is also areas of overlap between them. There are agents of both inside the Interior Ministry, Special Police Commandos, where they do overlap and they do cooperate. So it's a very complex situation.
The National Intelligence Estimate talked about how, you know, you can call it a civil war, but really it's more than that. Some would say worse than that, because, again, rather than just having the Sunnis versus the Shiites, which is bad enough, you have these groups within the same religion and ethnicity fighting against each other, even. You know, it'd be like, you know, if Georgia and Alabama were at war in the middle of our civil war.
Exactly. There are such elements of internal Shiite on Shiite violence. We saw that in Najaf last week. It is not a problem that rises to the level of seriousness as the Sunni Arab war with the Kurds and the Shiites, but it is there.
There are some who say, looking at it, I guess, from a little bit further perspective, rather than, you know, focusing on the details on the ground inside Iraq closely, but stepping back a little bit, who say what's really going on here is there's a proxy war between Saudi Arabia and the Sunni Arab states, nominally allied with the United States, and Iran, and that they're having this proxy war in Iraq, and we call it a religious civil war, but really what it is a proxy war between these two powerful states.
Well, there's a sense in which there's been a proxy war between Saudi Arabia and Iran in Iraq for decades, and ever since the 1979 Islamic Revolution in Iran. Khomeini urged the Iraqi Shiites to rise up and overthrow Saddam. Saddam invaded Iran. Saudi Arabia backed Saddam strongly. King Fahd called Saddam his friend. So in a way, that just went on and on and on. And what we're seeing now is a new manifestation of it, where instead of the Sunnis being on top, the Shiites are. But what we want to avoid at all costs is for this surreptitious or behind-the-scenes struggle of Iran and Saudi Arabia and Iraq. We want to prevent it from breaking out into all-out war. The whole region could be destabilized by that, and it would not hold the United States harmless if it happened.
Well, do you support immediate withdrawal?
I support a phased withdrawal. Scott, you couldn't get, logistically speaking, it's impossible to have an immediate withdrawal. It takes time to get all that equipment, all those men out, and you don't want to bring them out in such a way that there are a few left behind that are open to getting their throats slit. You know, you have to withdraw them in such a way that they remain secure while they're being withdrawn.
Sure. Well, I guess I meant with all due care.
Yeah. Well, with all due speed. I would say that we need to negotiate ourselves out of that as we're withdrawing, because you don't want to just create a vacuum there and have the situation collapse even more. As I said, that wouldn't be good for the world economy. It wouldn't be good for poor people. It wouldn't be good for anybody. It wouldn't be good for the Iraqis. So I think the real problem is that there hasn't been enough attention to getting a political solution. There's not a military solution here.
I would tend to argue that there is no political solution to it, that America just, you know, if you really want to fix the problem, you'd have to rewind to 2003 and not invade. That what's happened now is we've set the place up for a regional war, and, you know, I don't know how to negotiate our way out of it. Do you?
That's a long conversation, Scott. I'm going to have to go. But what I would say is that all problems have political solutions. It's a matter of the will and the resources to find them.
Well, I sure appreciate your time. Professor
Juan
Cole. I'm sorry. Professor Juan Cole from the University of Michigan. His website is juancole.com. Thanks again.
Take care.